Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, tackling education reform in Michigan.
I am convinced this is going to happen in Michigan, no matter what, over the next 10 years.
Plus, looking back at Dr. Jack Kevorkian, it was 22 years ago today that he was first charged with murder.
Kevorkian himself was more a scientist than a doctor. He was an intellectual. He was fascinated by symptoms, obsessed with death, and obsessed with the idea of organ transplants.
And a view from inside China's growing auto industry.
So there's been a sea change in terms of their perspective of themselves vis-a-vis the United States. Chinese like to see themselves as equals and increasingly, in some meetings, as leaders.
These stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside on this unusually warm, foggy day, at least here in Ann Arbor. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was on this day in 1990 that Jack Kevorkian was first charged with murder. We'll look back at the man and the controversy he inspired. Also on today's show, Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors all saw their November sales increase. But what about the world's largest car market, China? We'll check in on auto sales there and what they mean for the domestic auto industry. But first, let's turn to some very big changes that could be on the horizon for public schools in Michigan. A group assembled by Governor Snyder has served up recommendations that are summed up by the slogan, "Anytime, any place, any way, and any pace." A coordinated series of draft and introduced bills could reshape public education in our state, not only giving students many more options, but changing education funding in Michigan. Let's take a close look now as we talk with Jeff Williams of Public Sector Consultants and from MLive, reporter Tim Martin, who's been covering the school reform movement extensively. Welcome to both of you. Jeff, can you start out by digging deeper for us? Explain what any time, any place, any way, and any pace would actually mean for students in Michigan?
Well, we call them collectively the Anys, and it's a way to kind of open up the school experience for students. And the concept is that just like students have access to cell phones or computers, or if they go to the library, you know, thousands of books, they're learning outside of the traditional kind of 8:15 to 3 p.m. environment. This would open them to learning in an organized fashion at any time, in any place, in any method. Another way to think of it is this is saying that if a student learns math best via a computer, and that same student learns English best in a small discussion group, and that same student learns biology best in a classroom with 25 peers, that's exactly what could happen. It would really tailor the learning to each student's style.
I could only imagine that this would be extraordinarily difficult for school administrators and teachers to put a program like this together. How would you keep track of where a kid is and what this kid's doing?
Well, in some ways, this is, if you think of the best teachers you had growing up or in college or any post-secondary education, the very best teachers do this kind of learning right now, today, and have done for the last 50 years. They really match how they teach to the individual student. The challenge is, in today's world with shrinking budgets for schools and an increased number of children per classroom and higher standards, kind of teachers are getting squeezed. They don't feel as professionals they have enough time to do it anymore. We also have new tools. We have these wonderful online tools that, when deployed correctly, can really help student learning that didn't exist 10 and 15 and 20 years ago.
Tim Martin from MLive, as you are covering this story, what are you hearing from the many voices involved in this dialogue of education reform? Who is excited and in favor of it?
Folks in favor of it, I think, tend to be people who now offer alternatives to the traditional K-12 school districts, maybe charter school providers. Those sorts of folks seem to be the most fired up about the proposals at this time.
And opposed? I know we just saw a big letter from 72 school superintendents from West Michigan signing that open letter to Governor Snyder in the state warning reforms are untested and unproven. Talk about what you're hearing from critics.
Exactly that. Some of the traditional K-12 school districts and the organizations that represent them do seem to be feeling that these proposed changes are coming too fast and that these proposed changes may be too sweeping. Part of that debate, I think, is financial. A lot of school districts in the state have already been feeling some financial pressures given some cuts that have been made in recent years. And I think they're worried about the model to some extent. They are worried that some of this is unproven, untested, but they're also worried about what it might mean for them from a financial standpoint.
In fact, I'd like both of you now to help us kind of drill down more. There's a draft document written by Richard McClellan that would really, really overhaul the state's school funding law. Can you give us kind of a sense of what that's about, Jeff?
Michigan's school laws are really in two big sections. There's one called the school code. That's kind of the rules and regulations of how the school operates. And then there's the school aid act. That's how schools receive money to pay for all the rules and regulations. So the aid act is what Richard and others have taken a look at. The concept is to break apart this what's called the foundation allowance. It's roughly the $7,000 or so dollars that every school gets for each student in their enrollment. Right now, for example, the kind of the gatekeeper, the way that a student would access an online class, the school is really in control. So if you picture two school districts right next to each other,
okay,
in District A, the superintendent or that building principal may be very permissive, may encourage students to enroll in online classes, and therefore it's not a problem. In District B, they may be very restrictive and say, no, no, you live in District B. We don't approve online courses that don't come from ourselves or from our ISD, so that student would be shut out of online learning. This rewrite would say that money kind of follows the student and belongs really to the parent, meaning if the parent said, I want my student to be in class for 5 hours a day and to take 2 hours outside of the traditional school environment from an online or from a charter for the next district over, then the school district would get 5/7 of the money and the other providers would be entitled to their portion. So instead of a kind of a really, you know, district by district, administrator by administrator negotiation, this would completely change the framework to say if a student takes 1 hour of class from you as a provider, you are entitled to 1 hour of that aid allowance to pay for that student.
What's in there to kind of make life a little easier for these administrators?
Well, unfortunately, there's not much in here to make life really easier for the administrators. But this is a really interesting debate because if Michigan does nothing, if we do absolutely nothing, we don't open the Aid Act, we don't reauthorize the EA, we do absolutely nothing on these bills, the world will still change. Meaning 5 years from now, more Michigan students will be getting an education online. 5 years from now, there will be huge pressure on underperforming districts to improve. So it's not a question of whether the reforms will come, and it's not a question of whether online learning works or not. It's a question of when. And the when is measured in matters of years. I don't think it's mattered in measures of decades, meaning this is going to happen one way or the other in the next 10 years. As a parent myself of a third grader, you know, I've done education policy for 20 years, and now I have actually someone in the public school system. This, you know, by the time my son graduates from high school, I do not expect him to be in a high school for 4 years, in a building with four walls and a ceiling and a roof.
Wow.
I expect that when my son is in high school, he will spend a substantial portion of his day doing something that to me looks nothing like my high school experience. Whether that's transferring between districts, whether that's taking things online, whether that's work experience, I don't know what it looks like. But as a policy professional and looking at the pace of change, I am convinced this is going to happen in Michigan no matter what over the next 10 years.
And is this going to be seen nationally, or do you just feel, do you see Michigan leading the way in these huge reforms?
Well, and this is a great story in Michigan where it's we have a collective memory and then we have reality. Our collective memory is we have been a leader in the past. We have an organization called the Michigan Virtual University. We also have GenNet out of the Genesee ISD. We have two very strong and nationally leading organizations in online learning here in the state. So our collective memory is, when we think about it, oh, we're a national leader. Here's the reality. Tens of thousands of students in Michigan take advantage of online learning. In the two states in the nation with the highest proportion of online learning, hundreds of thousands of students today in each of those states take advantage of online learning. So where we have as a state over the last 10 or 15 years, we have led, we are at the vanguard. We're still in the top five nationally in terms of the proliferation of distance learning. We are not moving as fast as the fastest states in the nation who have hundreds of thousands of students and similar sized populations today.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty here on Michigan Radio, and we're talking about impending reforms in public education in Michigan as we talk with Jeff Williams of Public Sector Consultants and from MLive reporter Tim Martin, who's been covering the school reform movement extensively. Tim, I think a lot of what is confusing is that there are many, many voices involved in this dialogue. Can you give us some background as to the politics behind this push for education reform?
Well, I think there's been a push for faster, more dramatic change in our education system now for quite a few years. I think on the choice side, it really came to a head when Republicans were basically put in a position where they, in theory, can do something about it. We have a Republican governor who clearly wants to force some change to improve schools. He has a legislature that has Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate. So part of the reason, a big part of the reason this is coming up now is because there are the numbers there in the legislature to, in theory, get it done. I think there's been people that have been pushing for this for years and years and years, but there just really hasn't been the folks in office that might advance it at a quick pace the way there is now.
So in a sense, the table's set.
The table is set, but by no means is this table a clean table, if that makes sense. It's a tough issue that I think a lot of lawmakers, Republicans included, are struggling with to try and determine exactly how this can be done without upsetting the apple cart too much, but still making enough change to make a significant difference for the kids in the school districts that need change.
We're talking with Tim Martin, a reporter with MLive, who's been covering the school reform movement in Michigan, and Jeff Williams of Public Sector Consultants. We'll continue our conversation on the future of public education in our state right after a break. And also still to come, news of a name change for a luxury Ford brand. We'll ask what really is behind all of that in 20 minutes. And of course, we always love connecting with you. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. On Facebook, all you have to do is search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and on Twitter at Stateside Radio. This is Michigan Radio, and you're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing our look now at what changes are on the horizon for public schools in Michigan. Jeff Williams of Public Sector Consultants is with us, and from MLive, reporter Tim Martin. Jeff, give us a look at the state of education in Michigan right now. How much need is there for reform?
One of the biggest problems is there's not a shared narrative in Michigan right now about what's going on with our schools. Right, so we've got this disconnect. People don't understand. I'm looking at the latest statewide numbers. One in every four Michigan high school graduates is prepared for college or career, measured at the national standard.
Wow.
Scary.
One in four.
Scary.
So for the folks that are really against it, meaning they don't like this proposal, they're operating from the sense of, yes, but in my district or overall, you know, 70% of our kids go to college. That's great that 70% go to college. 17% are prepared to be there. So if you just look at my school data and go to the governor's dashboard, the other one that always gets me, the statewide four-year graduation rate is 76%, and our dropout rate is 11. If you add those two numbers together really quickly, you don't get 100.
Huh.
Meaning between 1 in 10 and 1 in 6 Michigan 18-year-olds doesn't graduate in 4 years from high school and doesn't drop out. Now, as a state, are we comfortable with saying between 1 in every 10 and 1 in every 6 kids kind of gets lost leaving high school? There is a clear need for reform. So kind of we have a big education problem in Michigan, and the scary part is we're average nationally. So it's not like we're worse than others. This is a national problem. We have the chance in Michigan to really kind of put the pedal to the metal and fix some of this, or we're really going to be hurting in 20 years when 1 in 10 kids didn't really make it out of high school.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Another issue that was the whole local control issue. You know, Michigan's got a long history of folks being used to having control over their own school districts, you know, whether you count that as 550 or 800 something. And these proposals change some of that. You could argue that it changes some of that for good reason, because some of those schools that are failing under local control, well, then what do? You know, you got to do something.
Michigan's Board of Education President John Austin's calling these reforms, in his words, a nuclear bomb. Talk to me about that.
There are a lot of people in that boat, not just John Austin, that feel that way. Administrators, unions, pretty much most of the folks in K-12 districts as we knew them and grew up with them are nervous about this kind of thing, mm-hmm. because, as Jeff mentioned, they just don't know what this is going to look like 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. Change scares people. So I think what the lawmakers are trying to do right now is figure out, well, how much change can we make without really scaring people? That's part of the debate that's going on right now, I think.
I think it's interesting, too, you referenced the letter this morning from the 71 West Michigan school chiefs. Contrast that with Board President Austin's public comments to date, where President Austin has said, you know, this is a nuclear attack. This is, well, you know, this dismantles the existing public school system. That's kind of way to one extreme. The third paragraph of the letter from the school chiefs this morning said, Michigan needs a reform strategy that recognizes and celebrates our strengths, exposes our weaknesses, and addresses gaps in a way that does not destabilize structures that are working. We need a reform strategy that is efficient, effective, and economical. I just note, again, as a policy observer, they still, you know, they're very much against it. They don't like the way these bills are headed. But here are 71 school chiefs who, in an open letter, have said, we need reform. Reform is coming. Let's talk about the type of reform. So even within the opposition, you're starting to see kind of the initial gut reactions. And I think from President Austin, you saw that kind of initial gut, this is terrible reaction. And now a week removed from that draft, you're starting to see some people in the education profession who are still very opposed to the bills as presented, saying we must have this conversation and this conversation must happen now.
Jeff, that's a fantastic point. I don't think you're going to find a very high percentage of people at all who are saying we don't need change. People, I think, agree we need change. The question is going to be how much, how fast, and what methods do you use to get there?
We're talking with MLive reporter Tim Martin and Jeff Williams of Public Sector Consultants about really impending reforms in public education in Michigan. Let me ask you a what if. What about kids who do not have a laptop at home? The schools don't have the resources that other districts may have to get kids online, or they physically can't get to better schools and districts. Would this make the playing field more uneven for underprivileged kids?
That is definitely part of the concern, that you'd be setting up a system where folks that have more and folks that don't have less.
With the asterisk that right now in the state of Michigan, there is an area of, you know, below average income that has phenomenal parental exercising of choice. And it's the charter schools in Detroit, in and around Detroit Public Schools. So this argument that somehow people with lower than average education, people with lower than average income won't be able to take advantage of choice ignores the choices that have really changed the enrollment of Detroit Public Schools over the last 10 years. And there's a huge number of charter schools. So we need to kind of separate out. There's a difference between not being able to exercise the choice, which I think is false, and not having a high quality series of choices to pick from, which I think there, again, it gets us back to that quality argument, that just because you can choose doesn't mean that your options are of higher quality.
And I think there are some pieces of this plan, too, that would call to try and address that issue of access. There would be perhaps more opportunities for organizations, companies to become more involved in certain aspects of education, and perhaps some of those models help kids get access to technology, to computers and internet access that they might not otherwise have.
I'm going to ask you both, can we say, speaking of access, can we truly say that every parent who wants to see their child put into a charter school, that there is a place in a charter school for that child? Are there kids who are slipping through the cracks, who can't get into that better charter school?
I think the latter. There are clearly students in Michigan today slipping through the cracks and don't have a quality public education, be it traditional district or charter school or even some of the private schools. There are areas of the state that are hugely in need of improved education. That again gets us back to the quality, and it gets us back to equity of funding, and it gets us back into something that these bills don't address, which is capital, meaning we have some wonderful buildings in our urban areas that are too big in the sense of the student population doesn't support it anymore and in the wrong place. And by that, I mean the building was built 50 years ago where lots of people in the city lived around that building. If the, you know, if that city built a new high school today, it wouldn't be on that plot of land.
Right.
It would be somewhere. It would be 2 miles down the road. Still in the city. Same district. I'm not talking about moving a moving a building to the suburb. I'm just talking about the buildings are not where people live in some of our major urban areas. And, you know, again, as a policy person, unfortunately, once again, here's another major rewrite of education that does nothing on the capital side. And that's disappointing.
Tim, when do you expect to see any movement on all of these proposals? There's a lot of talk, a lot of proposals being written. When do you think we might see movement?
Oh, you ask a fantastic question, which I wish I knew the specific answer to. I can tell you the one piece that might get taken up within the next couple of weeks would be related to the Education Achievement Authority, which is now a district that includes only 15 Detroit schools. In theory, if that gets put into state law, it could expand to include many of the lowest achieving 5% schools throughout the state. That is the piece that, if anything is going to happen within the next couple of weeks, that would be the piece that's going to happen. It looks like most of it is going to be pushed into 2013 at this point.
And what do either of you think would happen? I know Detroit school leaders are making noises about pulling Detroit schools out and breaking the agreement with Eastern Michigan University. What do you think would happen to the EAA if that comes true?
I think the only certainty regarding the EAA at this time, whether the bills pass or don't pass, is lawsuits. This is headed to the court to, even if the bill is passed, to clarify the powers of the EAA, to clarify whether you can leave the EAA. I mean, I think we're headed to the courts no matter what, which is a shame because, you know, we're 9 months away from the start of the next school year. We're 9 months away from 1.5 million Michigan school children going into a school district for whatever the next academic year is. This is a massive system, millions of children and billions of dollars, and it has a hard start date every year of the first day after Labor Day. So there's not really breathing room in here. There's not kind of time where we can say, well, let's let this play out in the courts for the next 1 to 5 years. We have 9 months before the people of Michigan expect 1.5 million kids to be in a chair in front of a highly qualified teacher, and the clock is ticking.
Jeff Williams from Public Sector Consultants and from MLive reporter Tim Martin, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A look back now at someone who lived in a modest little apartment on Main Street in Royal Oak, who drove a beat-up Volkswagen van, and who made headlines that resounded around the world. It was on this day, December 3rd, 1990, that Dr. Jack Kevorkian was first charged with murder.
That's my duty. I'm pretty pleased to have done my duty, not like other doctors who cowardly turn away.
Charged in the death of Janet Adkins, an Alzheimer's patient who had traveled to Michigan from Oregon seeking Dr. Kevorkian's help in ending her life. Oakland County's then prosecutor Richard Thompson said he was not going to allow Oakland County to be turned into, in his words, the suicide mecca of our nation. Michigan Radio's Jack Lessenberry joins us now. Jack covered Dr. Kevorkian extensively. Jack, did prosecutor Thompson achieve his goal of not letting Oakland County become the suicide mecca of America?
Well, not at all. Eventually, Kevorkian got himself sent to jail, but that was long after Thompson had been defeated and was no longer on the scene. Back 20 years ago, what happened was charged him with murder, And the evidence was presented to a district judge, Gerald McNally, who scratched his head and said, this isn't murder, and there isn't any law in Michigan against assisted suicide. So Kevorkian ended up being charged in that case with nothing. Eventually, the state did pass an assisted suicide law. They also claimed there was a common law against assisted suicide. But Kevorkian, with a big assist from Jeffrey Feiger, sort of became a national figure and one who, for much of that time, was perceived as being sympathetic by a vast majority of, or at least by a fairly large majority of the public.
Jack, most of America saw Jack Kevorkian through the 20-second soundbites on the 11 o'clock news or as a punchline for David Letterman jokes. In fact, Letterman never pronounced his name properly, ever. I'd like your thoughts. As you covered this man and you interviewed him and you came to know him, how different was he from the man most of America saw on the news?
Well, it depends on which Kevorkian you saw on the news at any one time. Kevorkian himself was more a scientist than a doctor. He'd been a pathologist. He mainly dissected corpses. And he was an intellectual. He was fascinated by symptoms, obsessed with death, and obsessed with the idea of organ transplants. He had the idea, really, what he really wanted was to find people who didn't want to live any longer, end their lives, and harvest their organs. But he was presented by Jeffrey Feiger, the attorney, as very skillfully helped him appear as sort of a kindly, sort of dark Dr. Marcus Welby kind of person concerned with alleviating people's suffering. The tactics of the prosecutors were very poor. They were very sort of oafish. They would brutalize witnesses. I remember one lady was just a poor housewife who was a friend of somebody, and they just made her cry. And jurors tend to be people who are older, and if you live to a certain age, you've probably seen some relative, possibly a parent, die in great agony over a long period of time. And so they're always, the jurors were always sympathetic, not so much to Kevorkian, but to the idea of ending somebody's suffering that didn't want to live anymore.
When you would sit with him one-on-one and talk with him, what were your impressions of him as a person?
Well, I think he was brilliant, after all. He probably had an IQ of 200. He could write one direction with one hand and another direction with another hand at the same time. You wouldn't believe it till you saw it. You sort of liked me because I could speak some languages he could speak, and we would do that. But he basically was interested mainly in science. He was a restless person, and he was a self-destructive person. He started a lot of things throughout his life and never finished them, started projects and not finished them. And this was the only one that seemed to give him any kind of notoriety or any kind of lasting presence in the public eye, which he liked, even though he claimed not to like it. And he was a very different individual, let's say that.
The relationship between Jack Kevorkian and his attorney, Jeffrey Feiger, was a big, big part of the whole story. Can you tell us what you observed between these two men? Did Jeff Feiger and his theatrical personality help or hurt Dr. Kevorkian and his cause?
Well, if it hadn't been for Feiger, there wouldn't have been any Kevorkian. Kevorkian would have been thrown in jail and convicted of something after the first suicide, and he never would have been heard of again. But Feiger certainly saw Kevorkian as a ticket to state and national fame, but he also was compassionate about him. Feiger's own father, to whom he'd been close, had died just a few years prior to this in great agony over a period of time. Feiger believed in this right. Feiger cared about Kevorkian. He genuinely had personal affection for him. He certainly helped Feiger get a lot of business. Feiger defended him for free, but he really cared about him. I don't think Kevorkian was capable of caring about another human being. And eventually, Kevorkian sort of sabotaged himself and Feiger by firing Feiger and insisting on acting as his own attorney, even though judges had told him that would be an extremely poor idea.
Before he died last year, he was 83. Dr. Kevorkian had finally done time in prison. They finally got a conviction. Then he came out and had been played by Al Pacino in an HBO movie. How much did that impress him or affect him? I know he was doing art shows of his macabre art. And how much did he enjoy that limelight?
He enjoyed it. He claimed not to enjoy it, but he did enjoy it. What he found out, he was sort of dismayed. He died very disillusioned. He thought that when he was sent to prison that people would demand he be released from prison. Well, as a prosecutor told me the day he was taken away, some prisoners don't usually get to hold press conferences. And so Kevorkian went to prison in 1999. The next year we had the famous disputed election, and then 9/11. And in the aftermath of 9/11 and two wars, people weren't that interested in the idea of people killing themselves or not. Now, the problem hasn't gone away. I think it's very important to stress that there's a lot of people who are still living lives of agony and without sort of a public representative out there. But the true Kevorkian, there's Kevorkian, the man and the myth, and then there's the issue. And those, while the man is certainly dead, the issue hasn't gone away.
In fact, you touched on something. I wondered if you saw anyone taking up the mantle kind of as the figurehead of the Right to Die movement.
Well, no, there are. It's sort of gone underground. There are certainly doctors, and I know some that certainly have helped patients end it all to, at the end of their lives. But I think the lasting, at this point, the lasting impact of Kevorkian has been twofold. We've had two states now, Washington and Oregon, have legalized suicide for the terminally ill. And we have the hospice movement, and it is undeniably clear, and even opponents of Kevorkian will tell you, that doctors were far too callous about things like pain management, and they've become aware, because of Kevorkian, they need to do more about that. So that I think that a lot of people now who are near the end of their lives can get, it's much easier for them to get pain medication to be sort of helped to a soft landing than it was before Kevorkian started his crusade. Now, that's not saying that Kevorkian wasn't right in some instances. That's not saying that he was right in any instance. But certainly, Kevorkian inspired the hospice movement and has inspired some states to allow the terminally ill to die.
Jack Lesenberry, thanks for sharing your thoughts and your memories of Dr. Jack Kevorkian with us today.
Thank you.
Jack Lesenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst. It was 22 years ago this day that Dr. Jack Kevorkian was first charged with murder. Still to come, the China Passenger Car Association is projecting sales of 20 million vehicles in China this year. We'll find out what that means for domestic automakers coming up in 10 minutes here on Stateside. It used to be one of the legendary nameplates of the American auto industry was Lincoln. But over the years, the luster of Lincoln faded. Sales topped out at 200,000 in 1990. By 2011, that had dried up to just 85,000. Recognizing that Lincoln's audience was literally dying off, Ford has decided to put $1 billion into helping Lincoln shake off its stodgy image as a geezer mobile. Tracy Samilton covers the auto industry for Michigan Radio, and she joins us now. So, Tracy, what's today's big news?
The Lincoln brand will now be known. Wait for it.
Yes.
Lincoln Motor Company. That's the same name it had when Ford acquired that company in 1922.
So going back to the proud history. So There's a name change. Do you think that'll be enough? Because Lincoln really has had a tough stretch.
Lincoln is most definitely not doing well these days. It's fallen from the number one luxury automaker in the U.S. 20 years ago to just eighth now. So no, it's not going to be enough.
What was it that got Lincoln into trouble?
One of the main reasons Ford got itself into trouble with its mainstream brand, Ford. Mm-hmm. And when I spoke to Alan Mulally today, he said, yeah, Ford had to do some triage here as the company was heading into the recession. But he told me that Lincoln wasn't as neglected as some people assume.
You can't build your reputation by telling people what you're going to do. So the reason it's been relatively quiet is that we delivered our full family of Ford vehicles, but at the same time, we've been also working on the new Lincoln vehicles.
So now Lincoln has this big splashy name change. They're going to have an advertising campaign and, of course, the all-important product. They have a new vehicle coming out, the MKZ, and it's still about the product, so that has to be something that people respond to.
Well, now this luxury car market is pretty crowded between U.S. brands. You've got Cadillac, you've got European brands, you have Japanese brands. How is Lincoln not only going to win back customers, it has to win new customers?
Yeah, it does. And they plan to do it both with the product and with service. So the MKZ has some really cool features that you don't see in other luxury cars. That you have a push-button gear shifter and a panoramic glass roof. And they're going to sell the hybrid version of this car, which gets 45 miles to the gallon combined for the same price as the non-hybrid. So that's pretty neat. Now, in terms of service, Lincoln Executive Vice President Jim Farley told me people are going to get this special, unique concierge-style service, a lot of pampering and attention.
people are not as infatuated with $100,000 sedans. They really want mainstream luxury now. And they're really interested in a personalized one-to-one relationship.
So when do we see this new look Lincoln in the showroom?
Early next year. And Ford is promising two new Lincoln cars by the year 2014.
Now, I understand Ford kept this Lincoln Motor Company name change kind of under wraps, deep embargo. But did I hear something that you got a kind of scoop about this a couple months ago?
Yeah, that was the scoop that turned out not to be a scoop. You know, so like, let's say a little bird told me, it was clearly something I wasn't supposed to overhear, that Lincoln was going to be renamed Lincoln Motor Company, but I have to confirm it. So I'm running out there, I'm calling people outside of Ford, all my sources. So, you know, and they hadn't heard about it. So they're like, Tracy, we think you're on to something. I'm getting more and more excited. Woohoo! And so I spent 2 days working on this. And over the weekend, I get this text from a friend of mine who's in the auto biz. And she's like, Tracy, you know that was in Automotive News 2 months ago, don't you?
Wah, wah.
Yeah.
Poor Tracy.
Wah, wah.
Well, now it's caught up. So it'll be interesting to see how this happens. And we appreciate you bringing the latest on the changes with the new Lincoln Motor Company. Our Tracy Samilton. Thanks, Tracy.
My pleasure.
Let's turn now to the world's largest car market, and that would be China. Chinese car makers say they want to crack the American car market. But how likely is that? If it's going to happen, when? And what would all of that mean for auto jobs here in Michigan? Let's turn to Michael Dunn for some answers. 3 weeks after getting his MBA and MA degrees at the University of Michigan, Dunn hopped a plane and headed to Asia. That was in 1990. In the 22 years since, Dunn has become a leading expert on Asia's emerging car markets, from China to Thailand to India. These days, he divides his time between China and Indonesia. He is the author of American Wheels, Chinese Roads, the story of General Motors in China. And Michael Dunn joins us now. Michael, the China Passenger Car Association is projecting sales of 20 million vehicles in China for this year. Put that in some perspective for us. What's the projected sales number in the U.S. this year?
Right. China has already surpassed the U.S., and this year the U.S. will get up around 15 million units. So China's already larger, and if we look out 5-10 years from now, China will soon be twice the size of the U.S. market.
Now, China's economy is slowing down, but when you look at the GDP growth in China and our growth, we should have such problems, right? It's a relative slowdown.
That's right. For the last several years, China's car market's been growing at a clip of better than 20% per year. This year, it'll be in the single digits, but that's still adding more than a million cars a year. All automakers will take that. You know, if you look at Europe, the United States, South America, China is still a star on the global stage of making cars and making money from making cars.
So let's talk about that big, juicy market of Chinese car buyers. Now, as for the Japanese car makers, China's having some pretty hot political tensions over those little tiny disputed islands in the East China Sea with Japan. So what has that meant in sales of the big Japanese brands in China?
Oh, they've taken a tremendous hit. Production is down up to 50%. There's serious animosity, it always has been, between China and Japan. And it's not only are they not buying Japanese cars, but in some instances are even attacking people who drive Japanese cars.
Wow.
Now, there's a twist to this that's not well known here in the United States and, in fact, outside of China. For every Japanese car built in China, those are built at joint ventures that are owned at least in half by Chinese partners. Mm-hmm. So every time Japanese car business takes a hit in China, the Chinese partners also take a hit in terms of employment, tax revenues, and profits. So look for the Chinese government to try to right this ship, separate the issue of the islands out from the business of building and selling cars in China, because in a way, China is shooting itself in its foot by not buying Japanese cars inside China.
Could it be that the Chinese companies involved in the joint ventures with the Japanese companies, would they switch alliance and go to a U.S. or European company?
That anything is possible, but you know, in China, they have what we refer to as the many Detroits of China. All of the cities are fiercely competitive with each other. So Shanghai battles against Guangzhou. Guangzhou gangs up on Beijing and so on. So it's a zero-sum game, and it's not immediately clear that Guangzhou would be able to switch alliances to a German or American manufacturer. Mm-hmm. It may, in fact, all the money may go to Shanghai, and that's a problem. inside China, because Guangzhou is the number one economy within China, the biggest taxpayer to Beijing, the central government. And if Guangzhou hurts, China hurts. So look for them to try to sort this out sooner rather than later.
Let's, if we can, Michael Dunn, break down the situation for the Detroit 3 for us. Clearly, doing the best in China in terms of sales appears to be General Motors, correct?
By far. General Motors is going to sell this year 2.5 million cars in China. Buicks, 75% of Buicks sold globally are sold in China. General Motors is second only to Volkswagen in the overall market with about 10% market share. Second in line is Ford, on track for between 550 and 600,000 car sales this year, roughly a fifth of what GM does.
Mm-hmm.
And then way down the ladder is Chrysler, which will maybe, if they're lucky, sell about 60,000 Jeeps and sedans this year in China.
Now, Ford, I know, is targeting sales in excess of a million vehicles in China by 2015. So they're obviously looking at this market, even though the market share is only about 2%. But they're looking at their pretty, you know, Ford sales were up, what, 39% from August 2010 to August 2011. So is that targeted sales of a million vehicles realistic, in your opinion?
Definitely realistic. Ford's never been in better shape in China than today. They've got momentum. The brand is getting stronger. People are liking Ford products. And most importantly, Ford's committed to massive additional investments with new products, including SUVs, which are the hottest segment in China today. And there is very strong probability they'll hit a million. They may even surpass it by that date.
Well, Michael, what about Chrysler then? When you say that SUVs are hot, wouldn't a shiny Jeep look great in Guangzhou?
You know what? Chrysler, in a sense, is star-crossed. They should be on top of the world in China because of their strength in Jeeps. In fact, Chrysler was the first American car company to enter way back in 1984 with a joint venture with Beijing. They built Jeeps. At that time, Chinese people considered Jeeps beneath them. Jeeps were something that farmers and construction crews drove, not the urban elite.
Huh.
You just didn't want to be associated with a Jeep in the 80s and 90s. Suddenly in the 2000s, that changed, unfortunately for Chrysler, through their acquisition with Daimler, sort of lost their ability to produce inside China. They find themselves on the outside looking in now, and they're working very hard to re-secure a license to produce their Jeeps inside China. So even though they're iconic leader globally in Jeeps and SUVs are the hottest segment, they're sort of feeling star-crossed and slighted on the outside, trying to get back in.
Michael, China's automakers certainly have not cracked North America or European car markets very much, have they? It's basically, what, Middle East and Southeast Asia as far as selling cars.
That's right.
But the parts and components made in China are making huge inroads in America, Japan, and Europe. Is that a good thing for our suppliers?
You know, the world of business is going to look for low cost, and China has proven itself to be an ideal place to manufacture simple parts at high scale and low cost. The big question mark that looms over this scenario, however, is that many, if not all of those companies enjoy subsidies from local and central governments in China. What kinds of subsidies? Energy, subsidized land, financing, even in some cases labor, rebates on exports. They get a tax rebate on exports. All of these feed into a systematic effort to export to the United States. And as you say, the growth has been sensational. But is it fair growth? Is it based on a level playing field? That's doubtful.
There are reports that some Chinese suppliers are actually making decisions to make product for their domestic market at the expense of shipping to U.S. customers. Do you see this growing? And how will this impact U.S. suppliers and in turn the automakers?
Well, Chinese automakers and parts suppliers in particular are always going to feel more comfortable at home. They know the regulations. They know the regulators. They know their customers, the language, the rules. They're all quite familiar to them. And now that China is the biggest car market in the world, they say, why fool around with trying to make things work overseas? Let's just stay home and make money in our own backyard. I don't know to the extent which that will undermine or hurt American automakers, but it is a trend.
Now, inflation has gone up in China, and you've got the change in the exchange rate of Chinese currency. So the cost to ship from China is going up for U.S. companies as well, right? Now, are there other countries in Asia, Thailand or India, that could take that business from China?
There's no question. Thailand in particular is a rising star in the auto industry. It will export more than 1 million cars this year, and it exports to over 100 countries. So once China's labor rates get too high and shipping costs get too high, some of the automakers will shift production to places like Thailand, possibly even Indonesia. But let's not forget the number one reason why the American automakers are there and the parts suppliers are there is that it's the biggest market in the world and has been the fastest growing. That won't change anytime soon. Mm. So it's not as if they'll flee China, but they're always looking at, well, if it gets too expensive, we need to move offshore. However, we need to keep one foot inside China to cater to this very attractive market.
If you're just joining us here on Stateside, we're speaking with Michael Dunn, who's a top expert on China's auto industry. He's president of Dunn & Company, Hong Kong-based consultancy specializing in Asian car markets. And we're talking about the Chinese car market, the largest car market in the world, and what it means for, obviously, here in Detroit and in the Michigan area, we care about our domestic car makers. I want to double back, if I can, to the Chinese auto industry in general and ask you this, Michael Dunn. What is the biggest misconception that American consumers have about the Chinese auto industry?
When I come back to the United States, people ask, how soon are we going to see Chinese cars over here? And in their minds, they think, wow, it's the biggest market in the world. It must be ready to manufacture cars of a quality that the Japanese and Koreans have accomplished. Mm-hmm. Or if they're not doing it yet, they'll be there in a couple of years. Well, that's very far from the truth. Chinese automakers are at least 5, maybe 10 years behind American, European, and Japanese, Korean in terms of quality and reliability. So there's no immediate threat of having an invasion by Chinese car makers in China. Chinese car makers don't mind talking about it, setting very ambitious goals. We'll be in America next year. They started to say this in 2005. They're still far away from it. It's a difficult competitive industry, and you just don't turn a switch and now you can enter the U.S. market. So biggest misconception would be that the Chinese are about to be the next Japan or the next Korea.
So it appears that their strength will be in pumping out those parts and components to
markets. Which are much simpler. It's a much simpler business equation, just manufacture a part often designed overseas. We can manufacture it in China cheaply, then re-export it to the U.S.
I want to talk to you, if I could, a little bit about your life in Asia. You left Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, in 1990. Mm-hmm. Your life is based in China and Jakarta, Indonesia. How have you seen things change in your more than two decades of, really, you're straddling the two worlds, so you have a fascinating perspective. How has life changed in China and our relations, just the way the U.S. is regarded? We see mm-hmm. the Chinese students on the campuses here in a way that was never there when we were growing up.
Mm. Right. Number one, when I first went to Asia, the United States was the absolute superpower in the world in the early 90s. And what the U.S. said was right, or at least highly regarded, respected. Today, especially since the financial crisis 2008, China, when it hears America say things, thinks and thinks again and says, well, that's what you say. Now let's consider our own opinion. And our opinion counts these days because, oh, by the way, we're sitting on $3.2 trillion in reserves. We have a massive economy, second biggest in the world. And in fact, by 2020, we'll be bigger than the United States. So there's been a sea change in terms of their perspective of themselves vis-a-vis the United States. Chinese like to see themselves as equals and increasingly, in some meetings, as leaders. We're ahead of you guys. We work harder. We're more ambitious. We're more competitive. And you guys in the States have had it too easy too long, and maybe you've lost that the eye of the tiger a little bit. That's a big change from 20 years ago. Massive. Now, in simpler ways, when I first went to China, very few people owned a car. Almost no private people owned a car. Those that did were government officials. Today, it's common for everybody in my office there to have their own car and drive to work every day. That's a monumental change in less than 20 years.
Fascinating insights. Michael Dunn, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Michael Dunn is president of Dunn and Company, based in Hong Kong, and he's the author of American Wheels, Chinese Roads, the story of General Motors in China. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Our contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk again tomorrow at 3.